Hello and welcome to the Hoop Collective podcast. We talk about the NBA. Joining us from Boston is Jackie McMullen. Hi, Jackie. How are you?
I am nifty.
Went to the Celtics Heat game last night, I believe.
It did.
Jimmy Potential Butler, Eastern man. Conference Finals win, matchup.
I don't know if I'm going to go that far.
Okay.
But you feel free Mr. Predictor that you are, feel free
take.
To do that.
Joining us from Dallas is Timothy Band McMahon. Tim, we have to start.
Aggregators put Windhorse Bucks won't even make the East Finals in the headline.
I know, right?
That's it's awesome. Already it's being typed as we speak. McMahon, you had a spectacular story this week on the blown call in that Spurs-Rockets game. You were down in San Antonio there that night. I don't know if you expected that kind of game when you reported for
duty. No, I went down there to try to work on a project and got no work done on that project. So
the best part about it was I was on another assignment that night and sort of out of – I was in a gym but not in an NBA gym. And I was sort of out of communicado. And so I'm out in L.A. right now. So I was sort of behind all of it. And I sign on to Twitter. And because of the engagement with your tweet, it was the first thing that popped up on my feed. It's right off the bat. Rockets are expecting the NBA to FedEx them a victory. I'm sure all of our listeners know what we're talking about, the James Harden dunk that was ruled a non-dunk. This is a wild one, Tim, and I'm just going to let you sort of take us through what you went through on that particular night before we get into the nitty-gritty of what's going on here.
Okay, when the play first happened, my initial thought was, wow, that's going to win Shaqton this week. I mean, you had the ball boy with the mop waddling out of the way. You got Harden hesitating to let the guy get the hell out of the way, going in for the uncontested dunk. I initially thought that what happened was he dunked it and it landed on his shoulder and went back up through. Obviously, you've seen the replay now. You know that's not what happened. It just whipped through the net.
So just to be clear, in real time with the naked eye, it didn't look like what the replay showed. Like just to sort of
well,
be a referee.
The ref had a little bit better view than I did up, 30 some odd rows in a corner. But yeah, I can see how they initially thought it was a miss. But dude, one replay and it's pretty clear. One overhead replay and it's absolutely obvious. And so, the Rockets are trying to challenge, and the whole thing is D'Antoni was telling them, I don't care what the bleep your call is, I'm challenging it. Okay, it's basket interference. Fine, I'm challenging that. Out of bounds on the Rockets. Whatever you're calling, I'm challenging. And they never, for whatever reason, he never got clarification of what they were actually calling. And by the way, the refs, I don't think, ever got clarification because after their game, the crew chief, James Capers, is saying, we thought it was basket interference. It was ruled just a missed basket. So, whatever.
So, real quick, it was ruled as a missed basket, ball out of bounds, off Harden. That's what the ruling was, ultimately?
That's what it is in the official play-by-play. That's what it was ruled. I didn't have any clue that this 30-second window existed. The Rockets clearly called the timeout. It is a thing.
I didn't either, but it is black and white in the rules. Whether or not it's always enforced is another matter.
And so the 30-second thing comes out because Caper says, well, while they were trying to get clarification, that window passed. To me, you got to tell them what the rule is before the 30-second or what your ruling is before the 30-second starts, but whatever. Then the Rockets poop the bed for the next 7 minutes and 50 seconds. Okay, we can't just, spray Lysol and forget about that. This should have been a funny little moment. The Rockets screwed up the rest of the game so royally that it turned into a massive controversy. And then, they end up losing in double overtime. Would have won, whatever. And the Rockets are, how should I put this delicately? Perhaps the most litigious, am I pronouncing that correctly? It's litigious. A fancy word.
Litigious.
That one. Front office in the league. I think they've overtaken the Mavericks in those standings. It's one of my little I-45 teams for sure. And so they're not going to let up. And, you know, initially the Rockets were like, hey, this is such a clear screw-up that we think the league office is going to take care of it. We're not going to have to file a protest at this point. And by the time the podcast comes
laughable.
Out, it's probably
that was always
done.
A laughable position.
I mean, that's hilarious.
And the whole award and the win thing, like, I was flooded with people just, you know, mocking that. Now, I think there is at least some precedent of replaying the rest of the game. Now, that precedent is like 51.9 seconds, or, you know, it's not 7 minutes and 50 seconds. That's a long time. You know, you can't just do that before the start of the next time they play in San Antonio. So, I don't know, man. It's an absolute mess. And, you know, the Rockets, obviously, from a PR perspective, aren't looking great here, but they don't care about that.
So the difficulty, Jackie, with this for... Yeah, go ahead, Jackie.
I want to ask this question because it's the one thing to me that doesn't make sense. Could you hear Mike D'Antoni saying, I don't care what it is, I'm going to challenge it? Could you hear that from where you were sitting?
I mean, no. No, I couldn't hear that.
Okay, so but my question. If D'Antoni was saying this over and over, as you suggest, then this play should have been reviewed. But what the officials in the league, at least people that I've talked with, say, that he never actually said, I'm going to challenge this. So, and this may sound like semantics to some, and it probably is, because let's be real about this. If they had just reviewed the play, they would have counted the basket, and on we would have went, and maybe the Rockets still would have lost, okay? Because that, to me, is the mistake.
They were melting
okay?
down.
Yeah. But, right, but the but with this is... Like, I was on Around the Horn yesterday, and Sarah Spain said the NBA should be embarrassed because they got this wrong. And I said, are you kidding? The Houston Rockets should be embarrassed. If you're going to use that as an excuse for why you lost this basketball game, you should be embarrassed.
Well, so here's I will real say
problem.
This.
Replay the game.
You've cut to the real problem.
Nonsense.
The real problem is the scar tissue with the Rockets. So in a vacuum... In and of itself, it really doesn't matter what the score is. It really doesn't matter what teams are involved. If a call is incorrect, you hope that the NBA would be able to correct the call. It really, the other stuff should not matter.
And ultimately, we're not talking about traveling. A very simple, the ball went through it was a basket.
I get it.
There's going to be missed fouls and walks and that, but a basket's a basket. That's a basket. Look, I will say this.
I get it.
The Rockets fully acknowledge that they completely screwed up. They melted down. Their defense was absolutely atrocious. You know, the last 8 minutes of the game of regulation was an absolute joke by the Rockets. Like, they're not running from that. But they want credit for the 2 points and blah, blah, blah.
But they are running from that. See, I'm going to stop you right there. Tim, I'm going to stop you right there.
Shenanigans?
They are running from that. Yeah, shenanigans. Because they are running from that. Because they know why they lost this game. They blew it. They got too comfortable.
Yeah, they
let, you know, I think at one point D'Antoni said we lost focus. If you lose focus over that, my goodness, you will never win a championship. You'll never, you know. So my point is,
I'm just going to say D'Antoni didn't say we lost focus because of that. He said we'd lost focus before that, and then that didn't help. Is there some whininess and all that here? Yeah, absolutely. But I also don't want to make it sound like they're saying, hey, the refs screwed us, and that's why we felt. No, they were screwing up before that. They lost focus before that.
It's complicated because the Rockets have a point. They are right. They were cheated out of a basket. But, you know, that's reality. It's also reality that there are missed calls in every single game that cost teams baskets. Now, this was egregious.
Well, and if you're the Spurs, you say, hey,
there's a clear backcourt violation on Russell Westbrook.
That's right. It's and, a can of worms.
You know, and then Tyson Chandler ended up with a dunk on that possession. So even Steven, you know, I mean, yeah.
Which is why they're not going to.
Well, if you're the.
Why they're not going to make them replay.
If you're the Spurs. But if you're the Spurs, you're like, come on, dude, we haven't won a game, and now we win one, and you're going to make us give it back? That's what the Spurs are really saying.
They will not make it back. Right. You know, the thing, you know, McMahon,
and
I
poor
still
Lonnie Walker has his breakout performance, and nobody's talking about it.
Oh, I know, I know. Right.
The thing, so I still, to this day, struggle with the Rockets' decision, organizational decision, to put that report out during that Warriors series last year.
Well, and the Rockets are still hoping that the NBA will award them Game 7 of the 18 West Finals as well.
That's what I'm saying. Like,
good luck.
It's very Come difficult on, to look at this without that scar tissue in the background. but from an organizational standpoint, it is Daryl Morey's prerogative to fight for his team. So even if he loses this, which he probably will, regardless of what they think, he's probably going to lose this. There probably is a value within that locker room that they, and maybe even up to the owner's office, that he fought for it. I just wish that this fight was happening when they hadn't complained about the officiating costing them a playoff series, you know, a year after the fact, because
right.
I still have
and
not
you know
recovered
what?
From that in my I
do
the
think,
Rockets organization.
I think the NBA office, if Sakakis would adjust. How many times do you see, you know, a few minutes after the fact, there's a review, hey, that shot was after the shot clock buzzer, wave the basket off, take it off the scoreboard. Or, hey, that three was actually a two, take a point off the scoreboard. If 2 minutes later they're able to review this and say, hey, that Harden dunk actually went
That's
through
the
basket.
That's a very good point. That's a very good point.
Add the 2 point. No, and then it is an absolute nothing. And so how this became this huge controversy is a failure on several different fronts. It's failure by the referees, it's an easy fix there, and then a massive failure by the Rockets for the remaining 750 regulation in the two overtime
periods. But I almost have
not to
take
beat
that
a bad
out
team.
Honestly, I think you have to take that out of it from a rule standpoint. You can't really think about, I mean, Jackie's right that it can't be used as an excuse, but so Tim Bontemps and I have a story out today that we've been working on for 3-4 weeks. That was actually always going to run this week about the coaches challenge. We talked to 15 coaches on the record about what they think about the coaches challenge system. And then I also talked to the league office, basically the two guys in charge of it, Monty McCutcheon, who's one of the top official administrators, and Byron Spruell, who's the head of all the basketball operations. And here's what I can tell you after having so many conversations about this. I think there's two things that came shining out. And what happened with D'Antoni is a classic example of it. One, the coaches are constantly confused about the process. They're confused about how and when to ask for the challenge. They're confused about what is reviewable within the challenge. They are confused about the strategy. Not necessarily confused, but conflicted about the strategy, which is, some coaches I talked to believed that a timeout, especially in the fourth quarter, is more valuable than anything, even overturning a possession. And the only time they would ever use it would be absolutely in extreme situations to save a game. And then the other thing that came out very clearly in talking to the league is that for them to do this year, and this is their first year of it, they're in their first 6 or 8 weeks of the system, they felt like when you did a review, you had to keep it as concise, as narrow as possible. What they mean by that is if you have a shooting foul that they are reviewing, and you go and look at the review, and you see that on the way to the guy shooting, he shoved somebody off to create space and a clear offensive foul, they're not going to review it. Just like in football, if this ever became a thing and you reviewed a holding call and you looked at the replay and saw that the guy was actually offsides, they wouldn't be, you know, basically what they're saying is you got to ignore that. And that is what is driving viewers crazy. There was a very high profile thing, Jackie, involving the Celtics and the Clippers where Paul George, there was a review on a Paul George a shooting foul, and he clearly on the replay, and I think Mike Breen and Doris Burke were on the call, where he clearly shoved Daniel Tice to create an offensive foul before going up for the shot and getting fouled. And but the rule, and this is maddening, but this is just the way that the league feels like it has to do it, because otherwise they don't think they'll get consistency from night in and night out. So the rule was they couldn't look back. They could only look at the play under review. So those two things are driving coaches crazy. And what I got to say is, in all the coaches we did, and the story is up online now, and you can look at it, and we stack the quotes on top of each other, from Greg Popovich to Eric Spoelstra to Steve Kerr, just all the way down the line, they're all coaches said the exact same thing. They're confused by it, and they don't like it. Kenny Atkinson, who was the league leader, I think still is the league leader, he got his first five challenges correct. So he was undefeated. I think he actually lost a sixth since we interviewed him. He said he still would get rid of it, even though he's been one of the most successful guys with it. So, Jackie, this is – and then let me say something else before I tell you, Jackie. This is not going away. In talking to the league office, you know, they're saying they're very pleased with it and it's functioning properly and that they need to fix it as they learn more about it. But I don't think it's going away. But Jackie, as this week in Houston showed, this is a very unpopular system right now.
It is. So what happened with Houston, I had to go on around the horn. So I made some calls myself that morning because I wanted to get a sense of, I was going to say, why don't they just get rid of it? Nobody wants it anyway. That was going to be my tact. So I actually reached out to a few coaches myself. I only got two or three of them. I didn't have a ton of time. And they said, well, they don't like it. And I said, so do you want to do away with it? And they're like, well, and see, there it is. Well, because I think as this thing evolves, it's going to get straightened out. And to your point, it's a very new thing. And here's the one component that I heard from the coaches that I spoke with is this. One of the problems or one of the struggles they're having is, never mind understanding the rule, is their player coming up to them and doing the little whirly bird. Hey, coach, you should review that. Yeah. Coach, I'm telling you, review that. Now, a couple of things. Number one, the coach may know that the player is wrong, but you know how this works. You show support for your players, just like you were talking, Tim, about Daryl Morey, showing support for his players in his locker room and his coach in the face of it.
Especially if it's your franchise player.
Right. And so I think sometimes the coach knows the player is wrong but feels compelled to do it. Now, the other thing is, it's not like football, where you have someone up in the up above, so when Bill Belichick or whomever wants to throw that flag, he's got someone upstairs telling you, yeah, throw it, or no, don't throw it. The NBA doesn't have that at their disposal. The coaches don't. They have to make a split-second decision. And I think sometimes they're like, well, the player thinks something is true when it's not. And I'll go back to Harden. He thought he missed that dunk, Tim. He was going to get the ball.
Yeah, he admitted it. He didn't know.
For a split second that he missed it.
Yeah, he said, y'all know more than I do after the game. He said, the coaches told me that it went in.
Right. He thought he missed it. I watched it. He was running after the ball. So I think this is another thing, Brian, that the players and the coaches have to work out together. Like, you have to say to a player, listen, if I don't, you tell me to challenge and I don't understand that A, I saw it differently than you do, or B, I just really need that timeout. And I think it won't make the coaches feel as though they need to do this.
Brian, did you get a sense for kind of what the protocol is for or what the process is for most teams? Like, I know, for example, the Mavericks, one of their back row assistants, Mike Shedd, has an iPad. And if Carlisle's going to challenge a play, he'll look at Shedd and say, you know, basically yay or nay. Shedd will dial up a real quick replay of it and give them thumbs, you know, yes, challenge it or don't challenge it. Is that something that's common around the league, or are the Mavs an exception there?
That's interesting.
So the one thing that we found out was that there's different systems just about everywhere. And one of the things that's happening is everyone's watching everybody else. There's a major analytics component to this, but not in game, studying before the game. So Quinn Snyder, who was on the competition committee, which is who basically told the owners to put this on, Quinn and I talked about this for 15 minutes. Quinn has spent, my guess is, maybe 48 hours of his life, maybe longer, just thinking about replay challenges. This is who Quinn is, if you know him at all.
Oh, yeah.
He's very intellectual and analyzes things to death. And he went on and on and on. I mean, you know him well, Tim. He went on and on and on about, you know, we reviewed it and there's 49 different it might not be 49, but it was something like that. 49 different, you know, things that you can do to take points off the board and whatever. But like one of the things that he said that is so really, two things I think he said. One is, and this goes to analytics before you decide whether to challenge. One is the value of a possession. Okay. Now, if you have a possession in the second quarter, you know, let's say you lose an obvious 2 points in the second quarter. Like on one hand, there's that possession doesn't have that much value because it's the second quarter. There's 50 or 60 possessions left. That makes each possession worth less. Whereas in the fourth quarter, when you may have two possessions left, the possessions become more valuable. So saving your challenge for then is, you know, it's almost like having a stock. It makes more sense to sell it when it's much higher as opposed to lower. Then the other thing he said that can't be overlooked is that just because you win a challenge doesn't mean you get the ball. It means you get a jump ball.
Right.
And now he's got Rudy Gobert, and so he's going to win a lot of jump balls, but it depends on a lot of factors. He may not have Rudy Gobert. He may not have him in the game at a certain spot. So that's the other thing that you've got to factor in.
That's depending on the circumstance, though. Sometimes, for example, if it's a charge that wipes a bucket off, you know, the guy scores, but the charge wipes it out, well, winning the challenge, you might go from no points to an and one. You know, so there are times where it's actual points on the board.
Yeah. So, I mean, here's what I'd say. It's in listening to Quinn, I'm surmising this. He didn't actually say these words, and I don't know if anybody has thought more about this than Quinn, but he's certainly right there. I think he thinks that it's almost never worthwhile to call them unless it's to save a game. Because he thinks that the value of a timeout late is so high. But there are other people I've talked to who have had who've said their analytics groups have come to them and said, NBA games are generally determined by, you know, 3 or 4 points. If you can take a two, oh my gosh, a three-pointer off the board or add it to the board, whether it's in the first quarter or whether it's in the last minute of the game, you do it. And so these are all the things
every analytics person I've talked to has said that. Every single one. Where every player that I've talked to about that is like, dude, screw that. Like, you don't want to waste them early. You know, I remember, like, I had the first kind of game-deciding challenge when a late foul on Damian Lillard was overturned with seconds remaining in Dallas. And I remember Lillard basically saying, you know, we've got to save those challenges for those kind of situations because, you know, if you're down 15 early or whatever, he's like, you're either going to come back or you're not. But 2 points then is not that important. 2 points at the end of the game, you know, that could decide it. I also remember Terry Stotts and Lillard talking about, you know, Terry went around and had serious conversations with, especially, you know, with every player, but especially his key guys. And was like, listen, I've got to be able to trust you. If you're telling me to, you know, you didn't foul a guy or whatever, if you're telling me to challenge a play, you have to be right. If you're wrong, I'm not going to trust you again. And so obviously Lillard was right in that case.
Right. But well, see, I think too, though, the reason why there will be times you can do a earlier challenge is, and I saw one, I can't remember, because, you know, now there's challenges every game. They all run together for me. But one of them was, I wish I could remember, the Celtics were playing somebody and the other team was on a run, and it was a charging call, but they called it a block. They called it a block, and the ball went in. So Brad challenged it because this team was on a run and the Celtics were bleeding. So what happened was they reviewed it and the Celtics were correct. It was a charge, not a block. So not only did you take a basket away, but you know how charges are. It's a great momentum swinger. So I thought it was a good time in the game to use that challenge because it not only stopped the bleeding, it changed momentum a little bit. And I think sometimes earlier in the game, it's worth doing that.
Yeah, so that's what the coaches are all figuring out, the strategy. But before we move on from this, I just want to say, first off, about 45% of the calls are being confirmed. And a couple of coaches complained that it was a little low, but if it was 100%, then the officials would be getting 100% of the calls wrong. you'd like to think the officials are getting some of them right, and they are. The other thing I'm going to say is that one of the biggest complaints that we heard over the last few years about those last 2 minute reports. How many times did we hear players or coaches say, well, the league admitted it was a mistake, but what can be done now? Well, this is what can be done. And I know that it's not a perfect scenario, but they are installing a system where you can fix a mistake that a referee made. And also, the referees are out there. You know, people are like LeBron. I think it was about a week and a half ago. It was a game in New Orleans, and there was a frustrating one that was not overturned. And LeBron came over to the broadcast booth, which was the game was on ESPN, and said loud enough for the national TV mics to hear, "You know, they're never going to overturn a call and make themselves look bad." In actuality, they've turned it over about 45% of the time, and they are correcting fixable mistakes. Well, he was just frustrated in the moment. So, you know, there are positives coming out of it. It's just that it's got a public relations problem, and the coaches, it's got a public relations problem within the coaches who are actually making the decisions. So, we'll see. But obviously, the situation with Houston was it didn't come out, anybody came out looking good at all on that. I will say, though, McMahon, when I did watch the replay of it, you mentioned the ball boy who had come out to like wipe up sweat. I thought that the official got blinded by him because the official was running right where he was going. And I thought, oh, maybe the official just missed it. Maybe the official was trying to get out of the way of the ball boy and he didn't see. But when I watched the replay, the ball boy did get out of the way and the official didn't take his eyes off of it.
Hello, no one is available to take your call.
Hey, real quick, Andrew, I wanted to ask you something very important. What's your favorite part of a basketball game?
The basketball.
I know that you like the pregame ice cream with the sprinkles.
Oh, it's right? The pregame ice cream. Yes, that's definitely it.
Yeah, but you're a little bit of an outlier because we all know that the favorite part of basketball is a buzzer beater. And right now, TISO has a tremendous new promotion where every time a buzzer beater happens, fans can get rewarded with flyaway trips, autographed merchandise, game tickets, and more. And you can sign up for it at us.tisoshop.com/buzzerbeater for your chance to win. And pretty soon they're going to be drawing for a trip to the 2020 All-Star Game, which is in Chicago, where I hope it will not be negative 10. If it's not negative 10, it would be gorgeous to be there. And you know about TISO. They're the official watch of the NBA. All of their timepieces deliver quality performance and traditional luxury. They pride themselves on precision and style. They've got their classic, sport, contemporary collections. And the cool thing is it's not going to cost you $25,000. And they got a great variety of watches. You can get touch watches, sport, classic, trendy. You can shop those timepieces at us.tisoshop.com and, of course, at jewelry stores nationwide. You already know this, but I'll remind you that TISO is the official timekeeper of the NBA, and they're bringing you this special opportunity every time there's a buzzer beater, whether or not it's reviewed by the Coach's Challenge. You can follow #ThisIsYourTime and TISO.us on Facebook and Instagram for more information. So, Jackie, you went to this Heat-Celtics game last night. Now, it was the second night of a back-to-back for the Heat. They didn't put their best foot forward. But you were saying to me earlier, Jimmy Butler had another great game. He had a great game in Toronto the night before where the Heat delivered the Raptors their first home loss of the year. So the Heat themselves are 8-0 at home. They're the only team to have won in Milwaukee this year. They're the only team to have won in Toronto this year. The Celtics still have a perfect home record. The Heat couldn't pull off the triumvirate. But you were talking about how impressed you were with Jimmy Butler and the Heat in general. But Jimmy Butler, who's putting up really good numbers for them.
Well, he is, and he's doing it in the way that I think every team that had him before would have hoped he could have done for them. There's not a lot of histrionics. He's just, he plays so hard. I was watching him. Jaylen Brown was guarding him. If Marcus Smart were healthy, Marcus Smart, by the way, the abdomen thing is going to be okay. He just missed the game last night because he was sick. He has that flu thing that everybody seems to be everywhere in all of America.
I'm worried about it. I'm around these teams. I'm like, how can I avoid getting sick?
No, I understand. But But anyhow, so normally I think Marcus Smart would have been banging with him, but I was just watching him. You know, he was shooting threes. He shot the ball really well from the three-point line, but he just knew with Jaylen Brown, I'm going to take him into the post, and I was just watching him bang him and bang him and bang him. He's so physical, and there is still a place for that in spots for in this game, and he just wears guys out being that physical. But his assist percentage is 30. That's a good number, really good number. And he's trying to make these guys work, and there's so many young guys. I mean, Duncan Robinson looks 12 years old, and he played really well last night, too, by the way. A kid that went to Williams for a year.
Yeah, he's from New England.
Had a lot of family. Yeah, had a lot of family there. So I just think, you know, we had asked a lot. I think many of us dismissed the idea of Jimmy Butler being able to carry the mantle as a number one. Now, he needs help. This team isn't, you know, he could use some other bodies. Dragic didn't play last night. But I'm impressed with the way he's handling himself, both on and off the floor. I was watching him before the game in the locker room with these young players. You know, he's in their face, but not in the way certainly he was in Minnesota, let's say. And I think he's found a good home. I think this is a really good match for both the Heat and Jimmy Butler.
So, Tim, Jimmy Butler, he's a bit of a polarizing player. I think a lot of people want him on their team. I just don't know if everybody wanted to pay him a 4-year max contract. I really think that's what held the 76ers back, because they obviously could have done that. But the early returns, I think the Heat rolled the dice a little bit, not because of his personality, but because of his health. And he's actually not, if you look at his raw numbers, he's actually not playing, I think, as well as he could. But you can't look at what the Heat are doing and not be impressed and consider them one of the success stories of the early season.
Yeah, look, the Rockets wanted to pay Jimmy Butler 4-year max, and he ghosted them. they thought they had him, and he left them hanging. When,
you mean in the free agency period?
Oh, yeah. They were ready to – they had trades lined – I don't know the teams, the destinations, but they had trades lined up for Capella and Gordon, and they were ready to pay Jimmy Butler. They thought that they really liked their chances, and then suddenly, you know, Jimmy had other thoughts. Which, look, he is, you know,
this was before Chris Paul, Russell Westbrook stuff.
Yes. Yes. Right. This was their plan going into July 1. Okay. He is the clear cut man in Miami. There's no doubt about that. You know, whereas that obviously wasn't going to be the case in Houston, but you know, I do think they're not at the level of the Bucks. I think it's obvious that the Bucks are the favorite. I don't think that Miami, you know, I wouldn't pick them against the Sixers, but they're not a team you want to see in the playoffs. And it's not just Jimmy Butler. Bam Adebayo has played great this year. You know, they've got a lot of young guys who are really playing well around Butler, which is interesting because I think there were huge questions about Butler as a leader. And, you know, for whatever reason, the young pieces around him in Miami, whether it's Adebayo, Kendrick Nunn, you know, the rookie Hero. I mean, they are really thriving playing with and around him.
Yeah. So, like, here's the Heat last 5 years. If I could put it in two paragraphs, LeBron left them, which was devastating to them. Then they got the 1-2 punch where Chris Bosh had the terrible, devastating health effect. So they dealt with a devastating blow to the franchise. But then they lost sight of what they've always done, which is they've always chased stars. And when they had one star turn their back on him and lost another star with an unsuspecting thing, they then went on a losing streak. They couldn't get Kevin Durant. They couldn't get Gordon Hayward. They chased a couple other guys. They couldn't get them. And they went through this little frustrating moment where they said, well, if we can't get stars, we're going to just make our own. And they took temporary insanity of the way that Pat Riley had done with this team for the last 25 years, which was to always get stars. And they signed a bunch of, you know, mildly above average players to star level contracts. And it put them into mediocrity hell for the last couple of years. But they've gotten back to what they do, which is getting stars like Jimmy Butler. They won him over. And the other thing they've always been able to do is develop, you know, these young players. And The drafting of Bam Adebayo was a pivot moment in this franchise. They drafted him midway through the lottery, beautiful draft pick, developed him great, drafted Tyler Hero midway through the lottery. He's developing very well, went out and found some diamonds in the rough, Kendrick Nunn, Duncan Robinson, and now the Heat are on their way back. And so regardless of where they are this year, although this is a great step forward year, in my mind, the Heat are back to being the Heat, chasing stars and developing diamonds in the rough. This is who they have been. They have not been a let's sign guys on their third or fourth team to the biggest contracts in their careers, which is what they, you know, took leave of themselves and did in 16 and 17. And so that storyline is definitely something to watch, because when the Heat are at full operational power, they are a beast, and we've seen it for decades.
And you know what, though? That front office also got really lucky, because Goran Dragic has been great for them this year. And the deal they thought they had lined up with Dallas was dumping Goran Dragic's contract. Remember, they had to go back and then do the three-way with the Clippers to get off of Whiteside's deal to make the room for Butler. They are so much better off having Goran Dragic instead of Whiteside. And you know, sometimes you just get a little lucky.
That's stating the obvious. I mean, I think given a choice, they always wanted to move Whiteside. I mean, I call him the cooler, right? But he, everywhere he goes, things go.
By the way, I had somebody pretty significant in the NBA who knows things, who listens to the podcast regularly. I always get as soon as the podcast comes out within a couple hours, I start getting normally complaints from people in front offices and agents and things. But every now and then, I get a compliment, and I got a compliment for you, Jackie, about your cooler nickname for Hassan Whiteside.
There you go. But Draj is coming off the bench, too, which takes a certain kind of thing. I mean, he's the second leading scorer on the team. I think he understands how it helps him as well. You know, it's funny, you were talking about them developing these guys. I remember when they drafted Justice Winslow, Brian. You know, the Celtics were so hot on Winslow.
Four first round
they offered him. Yeah, think about that. Yeah.
But they weren't, I mean, they not all the picks were, you know, wasn't like the Brooklyn Nets.
No, I get it.
Trade,
I get it.
But
I, every time I look at Justice Winslow, including last night, I think, yes, there's something there, but shouldn't there be more?
He's a good player, but he's just a role player. Adebayo is a
different. I thought he was going to be more. Yeah. Oh, Adebayo.
Yeah, so did they.
He's last year's Siakam. He's like a poor man's Siakam. He's the same motor, incredible motor. Can guard anybody. He guarded Russell Westbrook the other night. And then he's guarding, you know, centers. He's so versatile defensively. Really fun to watch. He's very, you're right, very, very
and, I mean, Winslow is versatile defensively, too. He's just not an electric type. I mean, he has moments for sure. But,
look out. Good motor.
Look out for the Miami Heat, because Pat Riley is back. They're back with what got them here. And I know that their whole Heat culture thing, the Heat culture can be there, but part of the Heat culture is getting star players. I know that that's, you know, that their credo is, you know, we're going to take whoever you are and we're going to elevate you. We're going to get you in the best shape of your life. You're going to play team basketball. You're going to do all this. But let's not forget that Pat Riley got those rings in Miami because of the Hall of Famers that he got on his team. So,
And in L.A.
Right. I mean, you know, I mean, Pat Riley, if you look at Pat Riley, this is a man who believes in premium. He coached in L.A., New York, and Miami. He has owned premium real estate. He has owned premium suits. You want to get Pat Riley to come talk to your firm, you're going to pay a premium price. Pat Riley doesn't do anything on the budget.
Halfway.
He is Mr.
Can I tell you
he
funny,
is Mr.
You know that,
premium.
There's a great story about that. I think it was in that long profile that our friend did for ESPN. So he told me, my husband and I. Yes, Wright Thompson. I was blanking on Wright's name. He's brilliant. I don't know why that would ever happen. But so we were sitting next to Pat Riley at an event in New York City, my husband and I. Just so happened that turned out that way. And Pat Riley's always sort of had this joke about how I'm from Boston, so he really can't talk to me about anything, which I think we've finally gotten over by now, I'd like to say. But he had no problem
God,
at all chatting it up. Yeah, right. But he had no problem chatting it up with Mike at this event. So he's sitting there talking with Mike, and I'm like, I couldn't believe the stories he was telling my husband that he's never told me. And one of them was that when the Heat won the championship, he wanted, to your point, Brian, to have the most premium championship ring possible. Mm-hmm. So what he did was he had his, you know, he went back to his house and got all his championship rings from the Lakers and had them laid out on the desk to show everybody. They were in those very, you know, fancy boxes that he kept them in. And he took them out and he had a designer come in and he was showing, how about this from this, you know, 87 Lakers ring and maybe that, a little bit of this from the 85 Lakers ring. And he had them all out there and they brought in some prototype of rings in those same kind of boxes and they're looking at it all. And it's all great. And they decide, you know, he has a pretty good idea of what he wants for the decoration for the ring. And he gets all done and they, you know, they take all their boxes and he grabs all the stuff and he throws his Los Angeles Lakers championship rings away.
What?
He doesn't realize that they're in those boxes. There were so many boxes on the table and he threw them out. This is a true story. He's telling my husband this and I'm just, my jaw is to the floor. And he's like, Jackie, it's a night off. So, of course, I never wrote it. But, of course, Wright Thompson got to write it. They went back. They searched, you know, the landfill. They never found his rings. He had to have them all remade. Isn't
so
that
the rings that he placed on the table for LeBron right. were, in fact, duplicates?
Yes. Unless it was for when he won the ring with LeBron.
Oh, that could be. I was thinking it was the first. I think it was the first.
Well, there was. There was the one they won with Shaq and D Wade. I don't think it was. I think he was doing this design for the ring they won with the Heatles.
Okay.
But
isn't that
an incredible story? What an incredible story. I still can't believe
it. Is it possible that, well, maybe that was the first ring. We have to get clarity on this because maybe this is why the Heat had this bad luck that he lost his ring, he lost his powers. But
I don't know.
It probably
would have
been
stunned.
The first ring that they won. But it's
all
an incredible
my husband
story.
Did was all my husband did was shake his hand and say nice to meet you, and he starts telling my husband all these stories, and I'm just looking at him like, dude, you've known me 20 years, you couldn't tell me this story.
Well, when I was in Miami for those years, you know, Pat would talk, you know, a couple of times a year. You could go up and talk to him, you know, at games mm-hmm. and stuff, but he would talk a couple of times a year, and he would come and sit down, and he would take off his suit jacket, he would roll up his sleeves, and he would start opining. And
he's the best.
He's really magical.
That's a good word.
Even if he wasn't in basketball, whatever he was in, he would have been extremely successful. And the thing that is so amazing about Pat Riley to me, and I haven't spent that much time with him, and you know, I was covering his team. So I was always mm-hmm. somewhat of an adversary. And even to this day, I think I'm viewed as a bit of an adversary because of the LeBron connection. But whatever you brought up, whatever situation you brought up within the league, not only did Pat have a story about it that he experienced, but that it was a relevant story for the moment. Like no matter what a team was going through, he was like, oh, no. This happened with me back in 87. No. This happened with me back in 94. We had this exact same thing happen, you know, with us at this year. And, like, he has this calming influence. I remember, you know, he keeps, you know, a bunch of bottles of wine, you know, in his office. You know, he's not Greg Popovich when it comes to wine, but he keeps it. And Eric Spoelstra told me a story one time about how during that first year with Miami – when they were on this, you know, just really difficult stretch, and Spo was just totally stressed out, and people were calling for his job, and LeBron was a handful, and they were losing these games, and they were 9-8. There was this one game they lost at home. I think it was to the Jazz, but I can't remember for sure. They had blown a huge lead, and the game was over, and Eric was in his office, and he was just upset, or maybe it was in Pat's office, and Eric was just upset, and Pat just walked over, selected a bottle of wine, poured Eric a glass, put it in front of him, and they just sat there in silence, drinking the wine for 10, 15 minutes. Nothing. Pat didn't say anything. And think about the high stress, high strung coaches and front offices that exist in today's game. Sometimes Pat knew to do things like that. And Eric, you know, Eric and Pat have, it's practically a father son relationship. You know, he has that ability to disarm situations, which is why, I think I was, even to this day, was so stunned and, you know, even alarmed when, after they lost to the Spurs in the 2014 finals when it was 4-1, when Pat came in, this is where I think the crossing of wires with the Heat kind of began. He comes into that press conference after the season is over and he slams his hand down on the table and yells, "I'm pissed!" He goes, "Tweet it out!" And like he was angry and frustrated and in my mind completely not reading LeBron at all, the guy who he had done so much to build a relationship with. It was so out of character for the Pat that I knew. Now maybe the Pat behind the scenes does that a lot and I just didn't see it, but Pat in front of the media always, even when he turned out to be dead wrong, always portrayed like, not only do we know what we're doing, we're smarter than you and we're going to outsmart you. Don't you worry about it. That was a moment. And now I feel like they're back. They're back into that spot where they're making moves that are smarter than everybody else. And I think it's good for the NBA. And considering, the bad luck that they had with Chris Bosh, there is some karma that should come their way about it.
Hello. No one is available to take your call.
Hey, you're going to want to check out the Woj Pod this week. We're recording this on Thursday. Tonight, Thursday night, Woj is up at Emerson College in Boston, where he is speaking with an Emerson alum, Thunder General Manager Sam Presti, in front of a sold-out audience. And it's a small venue. It's sold out in like minutes. But if you want to listen to it, you can, because it'll be on the Woj Pod with Sam Presti after they record it. And you can get that, of course, right here where you're listening to this podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. McMahon had to leave us. So, Jackie, the Forbes team evaluations came out today.
Lovely.
And a couple years ago, I got my hands on the NBA's books. And I can tell you that the Forbes numbers, especially when it comes to what teams make in terms of their revenue and then their profit and loss, are not accurate. But mm-hmm. I do think that Forbes has a good feel of what values teams have. And we have our first $4 billion team.
I know who it is.
I would have thought, if you had told me yesterday, hey, Forbes is going to have their first $4 billion NBA team, who would it be? I would have said the Warriors. And then and then they would have said, no, you're wrong. I'd have said, well, it's not the Warriors, it's the Lakers. The Lakers are,
New York Knickerbockers.
Yes.
Right?
And not only, just as a reminder, and it's almost a sad reminder because of the advantages that the Knicks have. The New York Knicks, according to Forbes, and this I do think that they have a better feel on the value, say that the Knicks are up, despite the disastrous 12 months that the Knicks have had, they say that their value is increased by 11% and is worth, they are the first $4 billion team. They think that the Warriors' value has only increased 13% despite moving into the Chase Center. I would throw a gigantic flag on that, but you hear about ratings being down, which they are, and that's concerning. You hear about, parity and all these things. The New York Knicks, according to Forbes, are the NBA's first $4 billion team.
It's crazy, right? Because the building's old, although they have done some renovations. As you know, I think there was a big renovation. When was it?
About 4 years ago or 5 years ago.
Oh, I thought it was more recent than that even.
If
you think about the New York Knicks as a basketball entity, they've changed now. They're finally out of purchase now, I guess, but their practice facility is nowhere near anything anybody else has. The Garden is just...
They renovated their practice facility over the summer.
Right.
But I saw I haven't seen it since it's been renovated. I saw the plans for it, but it is not up to the snuff of the other teams.
It's not like
the,
say, for instance, their neighbors, the Brooklyn Nets, who I think have the nicest practice facility in the league. And So it's kind of interesting, isn't it? But the arena's very, very, very old. Could definitely still use updates, even though I know they have been renovating it on and off for years now. And a product that just nobody's interested in, and yet this just speaks to the power of the NBA. I believe I think the number for the average team, wasn't it just about $2 billion, Brian? Am I right?
Yeah, I haven't studied it that much. I don't think it's quite $2 billion, but it's approaching it.
I think it's pretty close to that. Yeah. So
crazy. You look at some of these teams like the Sacramento Kings, the Oklahoma City Thunder, the Utah Jazz. They're all, $1.5 billion in value.
Like the Celtics, all them, they've got to be all close to $3 billion, right? The Lakers, the Warriors,
yeah, Lakers 3.7, Warriors 3.5, Bulls.
I don't
3.
Have it in front of me, but
yeah,
what about the Bulls?
Celtics 2.8, Bulls 2.9, Celtics 2.8.
Yeah, so they're right in the. There you go.
If the Knicks actually ever came for sale, I think that they're splitting the companies up, and spinning the sports teams. They're spinning off something that could theoretically make it easier to sell, although I don't think Dolan's selling. But if the Knicks standalone ever came for sale, not with the Rangers, not with the Garden, just the Knicks,
right.
I think that you could get more than $4 billion for it. The problem is there's only a few people that could buy it.
Could afford it, right.
There has been some rumors out in the financial press that Jeff Bezos is mulling purchasing a sports team. The team that people are thinking about is possibly the Seattle Seahawks. Obviously, he's a Seattle – Amazon is Seattle, and Paul Allen's sister inherited them. It's unclear. Mm-hmm. If I were Adam Silver, I would seek a meeting with Jeff Bezos and say, could I interest you in making a bid for the Knicks and the Rangers? Because that's the type of guy that it would take. There's not that many people that could afford to buy a $4 or $5 billion just team. I would really try to get them interested in buying
careful
the Knicks.
What
I don't
you
think
wish
the Knicks
for, Brian.
Percent.
Be careful what
I know.
You wish for.
I know. But, in this era where, the NBA is having some turbulence right now in terms of their business. It's one of the reasons why they're looking at these mid-season changes. I think that's just the truth. The ratings numbers this year are worrisome. This is coming off several years of terrific growth. If the league turns around and Curry and Durant come back and Zion becomes what we think they are and the Lakers win the championship a year from now, we could be talking about how the NBA are up 10 or 12% instead of down more than that. But
let me ask you a question about that. I mean, is it possible it's just there are so many streaming choices, television choices? Is it possible that the ratings will never be like they were? I mean, we always talk about the highest rated college basketball game ever. It was Magic versus Bird in the 1979 National Championship. No one's ever going to break that record because our attention is being diverted in 1,000 different directions. Isn't it possible that accounts for some of these ratings declining?
That's true. And one of the things about ratings is that they're all compared to their relative over the previous year. Like, very rarely do you actually look at the raw numbers, but there's no doubt about that. I just think that right now the NBA, Jackie, is in a situation
funk.
Partially
it's
of their own
funk.
Making, but Curry injury, Durant injury, Zion Williamson injury, not that Clay is a draw, but the Clay combined with the Curry injury has taken out the highest rated team out of the equation. Kawhi, load managing on national television games, which
ding, 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 load management. It's a big turnoff to people.
LeBron
big
in
turn.
The West, which, overall the East kind of devoid of the type of stars. I mean, Durant and Kyrie also injured. The injuries plus the fact that the big stars are in the West, it's sort of a bit of a perfect storm that the league is going through right now. But when you actually watch the games themselves, I think that they're still highly entertaining. I hear people complaining about too many three-pointers, And I do think that that is turning off some fans, but the young fans, I feel like that style of game. The older fans who, people aren't as focused on, and I'm getting into that group quickly as I watch my age go up in the demographics. But
you're going to seriously talk to me about this right now, Brian? Going to bring that up? Okay, no. Thank you.
But thank you both for the Hoop Collective podcast. Thank you, Jackie. Thank you to Tim. He had to run off early. We will be talking to you next week, and I really hope we're not talking about more replay problems, but they are what they are. Thank you to Andrew Hahn, who's producing it, and thank you, Troy, back in Bristol. Have a great weekend, everybody.